Okay, when Daniel Hone asked the coordinators of the magnetism program to give an introductory talk here, he was well aware of the fact that magnetism is a rather broad field and all the coordinators have a rather limited expertise really. So he wanted us to share, this afternoon, several of us to give it, to put together a talk over here, but unfortunately, all the other coordinators have disappeared for this week. And next Monday is Labor Day, and then the Monday after that, again, there's only one coordinator available. So basically, well, in the interest of delaying the introductory program, I have to say something. It's certainly true that magnetism and this program in particular is motivated and driven in large part by the discovery and synthesis of lots of new materials and lots of beautiful experiments. But it also has to do a lot, magnetism in general has a lot to do with very simple mathematical models and some rigorous statistical mechanics, some simple mathematical theorems and, some lattice realizations of quantum field theories, if you like, and lots of new ideas. And so what I'm going to discuss over here are more of the latter aspect and less to do with the materials, really. And hopefully, if we have something later, then maybe there'll be some discussion on the materials aspect also for a more general audience. Okay, so what I'm going to try to do is to summarize a sort of more at a qualitative level some of the recent developments in the studies of Heisenberg models based on contributions not made by me, but mostly made by other people, many of whom are going to participate in this program over here. Okay, so the simplest model that has been around for more than 70 years, the Heisenberg model, is basically a lattice statistical model of spin operators which are interacting by what are called exchange interactions over here. And there's a tremendous variety that comes about by simply choosing different spin representations, different lattices and different interactions in this model over here. Okay, so to begin with, what I want to do is to start with the simplest of these models, which in some ways is the most interesting one, is the spin half nearest neighbor Heisenberg chain. So the Hamiltonian basically consists of sum over I Si plus 1 with a positive exchange constant J over here, let's say, that is what would lead to the antiferromagnet. And this very simple model was first studied by Bethe in the 1920s, for which he developed the Bethe's ansatz, by which one can write down the eigenfunctions and eigenvalues of this model over here. But the Bethe's ansatz is sufficiently complicated that this very simple model is not yet fully understood. Okay, and a lot of developments on this model have come in recent years, in large part due to the work of Ian Affleck and his collaborators. Okay, so let me begin by saying that in this model, one of the simplest quantity that one can think of in studying this model is the magnetic susceptibility, is the uniform susceptibility. That is, if I apply a uniform magnetic field and measure the linear response of the system, then this quantity is called the uniform susceptibility. And although this model has been, this is called a soluble model and has been known for over 70 years, the behavior of the uniform susceptibility as a function of temperature was not known until the last 5 years, really. Okay, and, well, what one does know is that if I plot this susceptibility as a function of temperature, at high temperature, well, at zero temperature, first of all, in a suitable unit, the susceptibility has just a value of 1 over pi. Let me call it 1 over pi squared. Yeah, and as a function of temperature, at high temperature, one has the so-called Curie-Weiss behavior, because at high temperature, the spins are really decoupled from each other, and one can really study this very easily by something like high temperature expansions. And what was believed for a long time was that these a high temperature expansion would smoothly connect with the behavior at zero temperature, and the susceptibility will look something like that. It's only in the last 5 years that we now realize that the susceptibility actually comes in over here with an infinite slope, and there's some very interesting behavior of the susceptibility at low temperatures over here. Okay, and a lot of experimentalists are now looking for this effect, and Ian is not convinced that they have already seen it. There is something related to this which is quite interesting, which I wanted to bring up over here, is what happens to the susceptibility in presence of a boundary. Okay, so let's suppose we are at zero temperature, and we consider a semi-infinite chain. So let's say that we have this one-dimensional chain of spins over here, and there is a boundary at one end over here. So this spin does not have a partner to the left. What does one expect for the magnetic susceptibility now at, say, at zero temperature? Let's consider the situation at T equal to zero over here. So what one might expect, that the value of the bulk susceptibility is known to be 1 over pi square, so one might expect that far away from this boundary, the susceptibility should take this value over here, but maybe something very anomalous might happen right over here. Okay, but, and actually what one might expect is that this spin would have a slightly enhanced susceptibility. The reason why in a Curie lot, if the spins were free, then the susceptibility will go as 1 over the temperature, that's the Curie law, and it will diverge at zero temperature. The reason why the susceptibilities are finite is because the spins are all locked antiferromagnetically. So they not only try to align with the field, but they also like to align anti-parallel with each other, both of which are not possible, and so the susceptibility ends up being finite. So what one might expect is that the susceptibility for the first site might be somewhat enhanced, and if the first spin likes to align along the field, maybe the second spin, which likes to align anti-parallel to this one, would have some negative susceptibility. Okay, so in other words, let me define this object chi I, which is dmi dh. In other words, we apply a uniform magnetic field and look at the response of the system at site I to that uniform field. Okay, and then one might expect naively that slowly as one goes away, the susceptibility, local susceptibilities, will approach this constant value over here. In fact, the results turn out to be very dramatic, and not only does the susceptibility oscillate from site to site, but in fact it continues to grow in magnitude, and as one moves far away, the susceptibilities actually increase in magnitude as the square root of the distance from this boundary over here. Something quite dramatic. Of course, it reflects the fact that we are dealing with a critical system at zero temperature.
Are okay. You calling the field homogeneous?
The field is homogeneous, yes. If you apply it, so at zero temperature, the system is obviously critical.
Does it appear?
It reflects actually a divergence of the antiferromagnetic piece, because what happens if you go far away and look at this, the sum of the neighboring susceptibilities, this object very rapidly will approach the value 1 over pi, but each one of the susceptibilities will continue to grow. And so this is kind of like a Fredel oscillation, as Ian suggested in his paper. I mean, this reflects the critical nature of the system over here. Okay.
Why isn't it growing logarithmically? Why square root?
Well, that is because this is not a non-interacting system over here. So this is a special critical point.
Yeah, but you already know that the correction for the homogeneous susceptibility is logarithmic.
But that's a different... No, that these two are totally different effects over here. If you naively do a Fredel-like calculation in one dimension, you would expect it to be a constant. You would expect the oscillations to stay constant as you go to large distances. But this is a non-trivial critical system, and the susceptibility actually keeps growing in magnitude as one moves away from this point. Okay. I don't have a simple explanation.
Well, it's determined by these
scaling dimension of the staggered part of the spin operator, which has dimension 1/2, related to the fact that the exponent is 1 for the staggered correlations in spin energy.
Okay, well, one might naively think that this is a fairly esoteric phenomena, but again, you know, to bring up this point over here, that not only in magnetism, a lot of theory is evolving to try to explain the experiments, but experiments are also evolving to try to get hold of these interesting theoretical ideas. So Takigawa did some very beautiful experiments, NMR experiments, to try to look for this phenomena, and in fact he claims to have observed it. The point is that when one does nuclear magnetic resonance, this is a very local probe, because the nucleus is being used to probe the susceptibility of the electronic system. So if you apply a magnetic field, the nuclear magnetic resonance frequencies basically will depend on the applied magnetic field over here. But if the nucleus is sitting in some kind of a magnetic environment, the field that it will see will be shifted basically by the additional field that gets applied due to the electrons, the electronic system becoming polarized. Okay, so one can use this to measure basically the susceptibility near that nucleus over here. So what this kind of an effect, so now, okay, first, I guess if we want to study experiments, the first question we have to ask is what happens if T is not equal to zero? This effect that it continues to grow is only valid at strictly zero temperature. At any finite temperature, there is a correlation length in the system, and the correlation length basically depends on temperature, like 1 over the temperature to leading order. And so this effect will actually get cut off and will come back with these, this behavior over here will basically cut off and come back to the bulk value at a distance of order 1 over temperature. But then one can ask, at a given temperature, what are the distribution of magnetic fields that are seen by the different sites over here, okay? And so what Takigawa argued is that if you look at the NMR spectra, then you have the main peak over here, and I'm just looking at it schematically. Let's say if you look at the frequency dependence of the spectrum over here, there is a particular peak frequency, and then in most of these materials one would see some kind of a tail over here. Okay, and he argued that basically these tails in any given material, you always have some impurities which actually make the chain like material into disconnected chains. Okay, and so near the chain ends, these susceptibilities can get enhanced, and they can lead to tails in the distribution over here. And by carefully studying the magnetic field and temperature dependence and anisotropy, one can identify the piece that really comes from these from the local susceptibilities that arise near chain ends. Okay, and so in fact Takigawa has argued that this, because the theory for this is so well developed, he can actually use this phenomena not only to sort of study it experimentally, but also to get a good idea of what the hyperfine couplings in these materials are. And it's important to know hyperfine couplings, because those hyperfine couplings between the nuclear spins and the electronic spins are fairly transferable from one system to another and can be used to probe other systems as well. Okay, so this very simple effect is now actually also studied experimentally.
That means that the length of this tail would depend a square root on the concentration of purity?
Would depend on?
On the concentration of purity.
On the concentration, yes. So he's also studied the concentration dependence, yes.
So the value of the limit of width is dependent on the
variable temperature.
That's a common thing in variety physics, that there is a temperature for which the purity is not the word anymore.
Okay, this is obviously at low temperatures.
Yeah, I think what happens here is this sort of tends to the chain a distance of order inverse temperature. So if the chain length becomes comparable to the inverse temperature, or really the spin velocity divided by temperature, then it sort of cuts off the effect in a sense. But I think his experiments were done, and that limit at high enough temperatures that basically the region over which this thing extends was small compared to the average chain length.
Okay, in these models, okay, this is the simplest quantity that one can study experimentally and theoretically in these models. The next level of things are the excitations. And in these systems, the excitations are well known to be spin half excitations. And they were called spin-ons, maybe first by Fadiev. I don't know who coined this phrase over here. These excitations have been studied for a long time. And basically, whenever we probe these systems by some external probe, such as neutrons or optics or NMR, any external probe basically probes only triplet or singlet excitations, because the excitation only couples to spin flips, where you flip an upspin into a downspin. And so one has to ask, how are these triplet excitations made up out of these spin half excitations? And basically that's well known, that one has what is called a two spin on continuum. So if one looked at, say, this is the frequency over here and this is the wave vector, then for any given frequency or for any given wave vector, there is a range of frequencies over which this continuum exists over here. So if one was to do neutron scattering, and in fact people have done very painstaking neutron scattering where they measure the scattering intensity at different momentum and frequency transfers over here, and they are able to fill out exactly such a plot where one can see that the intensity of scattering is divergent at the lower boundaries over here. There's a divergent spectral weight at the lower boundary. Now these results have been known for a long time, but the precise form of the spectral weight in this continuum was not known until the last few years. Okay, only now some work by Bugurzi and collaborators using some techniques in conformal field theory have been able to write down exactly what the leading spectral weight is in this continuum. Okay, now not only is this probed by neutrons, which is the most direct probe of these excitations, but let me just briefly talk about the optics, since we will talk about that again when we come to two-dimensional spin systems.
Actually, can I ask an elementary question?
Yeah.
What is the nature of the spin half excitations? Can I think of the place where the oscillation gets out of step with itself? Is that the nature
of it? One can either think of, if we had an XY model, then you can map that model onto spin, to basically fermions.
Yeah, it's a domain boundary.
You can think of it as a domain boundary also, yeah. Okay, yeah. If I put on some Ising and isotropy, then there is a very simple way to think about these excitations. Basically, they are nothing but domain boundaries like this. And so, again, you know, such domain boundaries have to arise in pairs if you think of a periodic system over here. Okay, so this would be like a two spin on continuum.
Is there any reason I have the same picture in two and three dimensions?
Well, that's one of the questions I'm going to be raising over here. I mean, do such spin half excitations exist in higher than one dimension? And I guess Matthew would argue that you need some totally new way of thinking about it, different from one dimension. Okay, now if one looks at the optics, for example, the optical absorption spectrum, the spectral weight is divergent at the lower boundary, so this acts almost like spin waves. If these were spin waves with well-defined energy-momentum relation, then one would have delta functions in the spectral weight at these frequencies over here. Okay, and this very sharp, this will lead to a divergence in the density of states over here. Okay. So what one expects nevertheless, and this is some work done by George Savatsky and his group really, is that if one looks at the optical absorption, then the absorption frequency should show a very sharp cusp that corresponds precisely to this energy over here. And this energy is actually pi over 2j. And in fact, they have argued that this cusp is really a signature of this singularity in the density of states at these points over here. And they have also argued that this width over here is related to the fact that you have to think of these excitations as the two spin-on continuum over here. Okay. And similar issues have been raised in context of two-dimensional square lattice Heisenberg models about optical spectra, and maybe I'll come back to that a little later. Okay, now the next level of complication that one can introduce to these models is really to apply a second neighbor interaction. So suppose we have J1 sum over I Si dot Si plus 1 plus J2 sum over I Si dot Si plus 2. In general, if J2 is small, then the basic physics is unchanged. But there is a critical J2 over here. And numerically, one knows that this critical ratio is about 0.24, such that if J2 exceeds this ratio over here, then the system, the ground state becomes totally different. There are two degenerate ground states. And there is a gap in the spin excitation spectrum. And basically this can be best understood by considering J2 equal to 1 half J1, which is known as the Majumdar-Ghosh model. And in that case, the two ground states are actually very simple. Basically, they are drawn by lines like this. So the two ground states are basically those where two neighboring spins are combined into a singlet, then there is no spin correlation between the second and third spin, then again 3, 4 are combined into a singlet, and so on. So this is one ground state, and this one is the other ground state. And it's very easy to see that these will be the exact ground states, because when J2 equal to 1 half J1, I can rewrite that Hamiltonian as sum over I, let me put a 1 half over here, Si plus 1 plus Si plus 1 dot Si plus 2 Si dot Si plus 2. So I can rewrite these Hamiltonian as a sum of these terms over here, and this sum, sorry, I have this is, so I have written the first term twice over here and put in a factor of 1 half, and this is just the second term which has the 1 half interaction there. So basically it's a sum over three spins over here, I plus 1 and I plus 2. And basically this is a sum of nearest neighbor pairs, so this is obviously proportional to S1 plus S2 plus S3 square, apart from some constants over here. And so basically the ground state only depends on the total spin, and the ground state will be the one which has spin half. So you can combine any two spins into a singlet and then leave the third spin free. That's the ground state of the system. And if we consider this state over here, then it simultaneously minimizes all these, every single term in this Hamiltonian over here. So this must be one of the ground states.
Right.
Rajiv, I don't know if this is an appropriate question for your talk, but I was just curious how these second nearest neighbor interactions arise at the atomic level. They arise because some orbitals overlap or something.
Now you're raising, obviously, you know, that is the material part of the
part of the film. So how
yes.
Experimentalists tune these ratios?
You cannot in general tune it, but in different materials they come with different
just properties of different materials.
It's a property of different materials.
Of course, there's a zigzag spin chain. The most natural situation would be a zigzag structure mm-hmm. of a spin chain.
Which has a triangle.
So if one has something like that, so materials arise in all kinds of geometries. And in fact, many of the models that one might naively think are purely of academic interest. For example, I mean, in the early days of ITC, people started writing down models for spin ladders. And that was just because, you know, that was easier to deal with numerically. And they didn't expect it to be a model for something real. It turns out that, you know, that there are materials for which those are very accurate models. So, but it's a complicated story, really.
So the point is, there are structures that have that form with the two, the whole zigzag chain, and then you naturally get things to couple.
Well, he said the electrons can occupy intermediate.
Yeah, so it can be exchange overlap.
Yeah. So for example, in such a structure, you could have exchange interaction here and here. Mm-hmm. That's one possibility.
What happens to the spin gap if you go away from one half?
The spin gap is present. So if I looked at this model over here, this J1, J2 model, so this region over here has this power law correlations and no spin gap. And this entire region has a spin gap and degenerate ground states. And actually, this is a simple reflection of a very important theorem that keeps coming up all the time. A theorem that was proven in one of the appendices of Daniel Matiss's paper over here, known as the Liebschulz-Matiss theorem. And the theorem basically says that if you have half-integer spins for unit cell, then either one has degenerate ground states, which correspond to broken translational symmetry, as in this example over here, or one has gapless excitations. And this theorem is simply related to the fact that for half-integer spins, rotation by 2 pi gives rise to a minus sign. And it has a very simple proof, as I said, in the appendix of one of the old papers by Liebschulz and Matiss. And in general, for spin-half systems, either one has to have gapless excitations, or one has to have two degenerate ground states. Okay, and in general, if we have an integer spin system, then obviously this theorem does not apply. And so, one class of models that have attracted a lot of interest over the years basically are so-called Haldane gap systems. So initially, when Duncan Haldane argued that integer spin systems have a gap generically, whereas half-integer spin systems do not, I mean, that was considered a very non-trivial statement. But of course, now we understand that very well. And in particular, there are some models first written down by Affleck, Kennedy, Lieb, and Tasaki, some exactly soluble models, which basically by simple pictures like this, can illustrate the nature of the ground state for different spin systems over here. So basically this is now well understood, and especially in context of the Lebesgue-Matis theorem, that in general, when you have half integer spin systems, then the only way to get these gap states is to break the translational symmetry like this. But when you have integer spin systems, then you don't need to break translational symmetry and you can still have a spin gap. And in these AKLT systems, if I had a spin 1 model, for example, and let me skip the Hamiltonian and just draw some pictures over here. Basically, one can think of a spin 1 object as two symmetrized spin half objects. And then one of these ground states with a spin gap basically would be one where one of these spin halves are coupled into a singlet with this object over here, where this is coupled into a singlet with this. And because these two are symmetrized over here, there is no broken translational symmetry in this model. Okay. Okay. Now, in these systems also, the excitations, the element in the spin half systems, the elementary excitations are still spin half objects. And now they are domain walls or solitons between these two degenerate states. So basically, if we drew the picture over here, basically an elementary excitation will look like this. So it takes us from an A type ground state over here to a B type ground state, and then we can have another anti-soliton here, if you like, which takes us back to an A type ground state. Okay, and so this was first studied by Shastri and Sutherland, who studied the two soliton continuum over here.
Why do both of those things have to be up?
Well, no, I could choose them to be down. So you can study spin triplet with SZ equal to 1 or spin singlet. So you can study any of those. And so for most wave vectors, these are basically free. So it's really these spin half excitations are free in this model. And so one can also say that they are basically deconfined. But if we put in any kind of a coupling, typically between chains, or if I put in by hand a bond alternation into the model. So the model was if I put over here a bond alternation over here so that the interactions are different on odd and even bonds over here, then that will confine these excitations. And of course, it will choose one of the two ground states to be the ground state. The other one will have infinite energy. And so there is this phenomena of confinement and deconfinement. And this seems to be important for studying these spin pyral systems. Such as copper germinate. In these systems, basically, at some finite temperature, the system spontaneously dimerizes. So to begin with, at high temperature, one has a uniform chain, but at lower temperatures, there's a spontaneous dimerization. And so the system spontaneously chooses to break up either into this phase or into this phase over here. Okay. And of course, if there was no coupling between the chains, then these two states will be totally degenerate. But because of the coupling between the different chains, In real materials, one doesn't have an isolated chain over here, but one has a number of chains, and due to the coupling between the chains, which does not have to be purely magnetic but also could be elastic coupling, actually induces a term like this and leads to the confinement of these spin half excitations. Okay, so one can study, once one has that extra term over there, the spin-ons will be confined, and one can study the number of bound states that arise in such a system. Okay, that has been of much interest. Okay, let me go over now to the two-dimensional systems.
Could you just clarify one thing? Well, if you put in by hand this oscillation, then you'll get an oscillatory graph thing. But could it spontaneously break the symmetry and do it if you didn't tune J2 to J1?
Oh, what I was saying was that if, yeah. Oh, without J2?
Yeah, with J2, but not having it at the Majumdar-Gauss binders.
Right, so...
Yeah, would it spontaneously spiral down?
Any, if you had a coupling which was bigger than 0.24, then it would spontaneously dimerize at zero temperature.
That is not a confinement because it can spiral.
But it will not be. But the excitations will not be confined.
It
so
will not be confined no matter what J2 is.
No matter what J2 is.
It can spontaneously go in both states.
Right. So there will be two degenerate ground states. And the excitations will be those which interpolate between the two.
That's in the absence of spin phonon.
Yeah, and
no, also with spin phonon. The one-dimensional model of the phonon is also as you can find phonons.
As long as you have a single chain.
That's spontaneously spin phonons.
So it does, but
it will still have deconfined spinons or solitons.
Yeah. Are there any similar phenomena if I now look at a seemingly infinite chain, where could something drastic happen in different scenarios, different from the pure?
Well, this is not a critical system now, so you know you would certainly expect something to happen at the ends. When you say similar phenomena, what do you mean?
For the susceptibility, for example.
Right, but that was because it was a critical system.
Uh-huh. Only precisely at the Hausdorff point, yeah?
No. As long as you are in this phase over here.
Okay, I'm sorry.
This one is critical at 0.24.
Right. 0.24 is a special critical point, really, yeah. So until that point, maybe something will happen. But otherwise, if you put something, then of course something new will happen near the boundary, but not far away from the boundary.
But if you look at excited states, the spin one states, then the solitons want to go to the end of the open
space. Yeah, they will all move to the end. Yeah,
that's right. So it's
going to... Okay, let me go over to the 2D Heisenberg models. And so basically the simplest model over here is just a nearest neighbor spin half Heisenberg model on a square lattice with spin half. And the study of this model really became very fashionable after the discovery of ITC, since the parent phases of the ITC superconductors are rather well described by such a model. Okay. Now, let me bring up some simple mathematical theorems over here that tell us there are two types of mathematical theorems, rigorous theorems, tell us about the nature of long-range order in these systems over here. So one class of theorems are the so-called Mermin-Wagner or the Hohenberg-Mermin-Wagner theorems. And basically, they say that under certain conditions, there can be no long-range order in the system. So the spin rotational symmetry cannot be spontaneously broken under certain conditions. So basically in low dimension. So these theorems tell us that if we have a system with continuous symmetry, then in D less than or equal to 2 at any finite temperature, there can be no long range order. And of course one can generalize it to one dimension even at zero temperature, there is no long range order, no long range magnetic order, which breaks the spin rotational symmetry. And on the other hand, we have theorems which were originally written down by Dyson, Leib and Simon, which actually tell us conditions under which one can rigorously prove the existence of long range order. And basically one can show that for purely nearest neighbor models like this, for D equal to 3 and any spin, there is long range order. Some generalization of the original work of Dyson, Leib and Simon can be used to show that for D equals to 2 and spin bigger than 1, bigger than or equal to 1 at T equal to 0, there is long range order. So really the only system that has escaped a rigorous mathematical theorem of either this type or that type is the D equals to spin half Heisenberg antiferromagnet. And well, now this is a system where I think the numerical evidence is really quite clear that basically this system does have long range order, although it has not been possible to show it mathematically. The numerical study, and also one can study the system by mapping it onto the quantum nonlinear sigma model in 2 plus 1 dimensions. Oh, that was the Mermin-Wagner theorem. Says if D is 2, then
yeah, but more than nearest neighbor
action. Oh, none. Well, so there were two classes of theorems. The first set of theorems are actually much more generic. The second classes of theorems are very specific, and they would fail sometimes, even though you know you haven't really changed anything in the model, anything as far as your intuition is concerned. Mermin-Wagner would apply. So those theorems were very general, but these theorems, if you add second neighbor interactions, typically the theorems will fail right away because they are very specific. But that does not mean that the system will not have long range order right away.
I assume that in the second class theorem, when you say long range order, it's always antiferromagnetic.
For these models, yes. Okay, so by mapping it onto the quantum nonlinear sigma model,
does long range order apply to degeneracy?
Sorry?
Does long range order apply to degeneracy of the ground state?
What do you mean by degeneracy? For any finite system, the ground state is non-degenerate, but certainly the long range order would, and actually maybe I'll discuss it a little later. When you have long range order, you are spontaneously breaking the spin rotational symmetry, and so in some sense in the thermodynamic limit, the ground state does not have a definite spin, and it must be made out of states of many different spins really.
Yeah.
So in that sense it is non-degenerate. It is not degenerate.
It is degenerate.
It is degenerate in that sense. But in any finite system you may have a unique combination of them being the ground state really.
Long range order is defined only for an infinite.
Yes. Okay, so basically using this mapping over here, Chakravarti, Halperin, Nelson and Hasenfratz and Niedermayer, using some more field theory really, were able to write down the correlation length, for example as a function of temperature, and there's some very beautiful expression over here because everything is expressed in terms of simple constants like E.
It means anything you can prove in a field theory can be proved in a
field. No. It's mapping.
It's the other way around. Anything you can prove in a
field. No, no. The mapping is the sort of motivated. But so, I would say they are non-rigorous, but a reasonable. So it's a long wavelength.
It captures all the long
wavelength. It captures all the long wavelength low energy physics of the model.
Okay.
Right. But one has to ask the question, how low capture and how long wavelength? So, you know, at what temperature does such a mapping apply? Okay. So, in this case, actually, one can write down an expression like this. It was done by Hasenpratz and Niedermayer, and it appears to explain the temperature dependence of the correlation length in the lanthanum copper oxide systems extremely well. But that may be a bit fortuitous, because it turned out that when one looks at the correlation length for systems with spin greater than 1/2, that this formula doesn't seem to work at all.
What is kind of the formula true for finite S?
Well, it's true for the nonlinear sigma model. Now, numerical result has shown that this formula always applies, to the extent that you believe the numerical results, this formula applies at sufficiently low temperature. But that temperature can be extremely low, and by the time you get to those temperature, the correlation length would be enormous, would be basically macroscopic.
So even for spin 1/2, it applies at low
enough. Even for spin 1/2, it applies at low enough T. But surprisingly, for spin 1/2, it applies at the highest T.
But isn't it true that this calculation is only valid if you renormalize the classical regime? So if you go to the quantum grid correction, things will change, and you don't have this anymore. You have the one over.
Yeah, but it has nothing to do with the. So that's my point. So actually, Chakravarti, Halperin, Nelson wrote down a phase diagram. Temperature, and let's call this the coupling constant of the nonlinear sigma model, which maybe in the spin models goes as 1 over S. And so basically there is a critical coupling over here, such that if the coupling is bigger than that, then you have a quantum disordered phase. Here you have a renormalized classical phase, and this is a quantum critical point. At any finite temperature, basically, the system will appear critical if you are at temperatures higher than the relevant energy scales for order or disorder over here. So there was a quantum critical regime over here. So what one would naively expect is that this formula applies, as you say, in this renormalized classical regime. But as you go to larger spin, you are moving away from this critical point over here. So naively, from this picture over here, you will expect the renormalized classical regime to extend up to higher temperatures. Okay? But experimentally and numerically, this regime becomes less and less valid, because there's another crossover involved, and that is the crossover to a classical Heisenberg model, okay, which has a different behavior. So the classical Heisenberg model also has this kind of an exponential increase, but it has a 1 over T over sitting in front over here.
So isn't it true that if I would guess this exact B factor, in fact, is only valid at large S? So it's based on a small bare coupling in the sigma model.
It's argued that this is valid for even for spin 1/2. Numerically, it seems to be valid even for spin 1/2, if you are at sufficiently low temperatures.
How do you get rho s?
So that's a good question. So how do you know what C and rho s are? C is the spin wave velocity and rho s is the spin stiffness. And these quantities you can only get numerically. But there's really excellent numerical results directly at zero temperature. So these quantities are, let's say, known. Okay.
You can also estimate for large s.
You can also estimate from large S using the spin wave theory. And the spin wave theory itself works pretty well all the way down to spin 1/2.
Does it give this?
No, the spin wave theory will not give this, but it can give you the spin wave velocity as a function of S and the spin stiffness constant as a function of S. Okay, this requires a renormalization group treatment or something like that. This certainly cannot come out of spin wave theory. But this formula is believed to be valid for all spin as long as one is at a sufficiently low temperature.
What means spin wave velocity? Is it linear dispersion?
The linear dispersion. So if we look at the elementary excitations in two dimensions, The elementary excitations are basically spin waves. Well, it's believed that the topological excitations, like skirmions, have a finite energy and are not important, even in the disordered phase. Just the spin waves themselves will destroy long-range order at any finite temperature. But that's the Mermin-Wagner theorem, basically.
But technically speaking, this formula is only valuable when rho s is much larger than the temperature, right? Essentially,
sure. Right, but that's not enough. That's what I'm saying, that just that condition is not enough. There's a second condition that you have to worry about, is the thermal de Broglie wavelength becoming much bigger than the lattice constant. Okay? And when you apply the two conditions, the regime of validity actually shrinks as you go to higher spin. Okay? And in fact, so the fact that now experimentally any real system is not going to be strictly one-dimensional or two-dimensional, it's ultimately three-dimensional. And so the regime of validity of, say, a two-dimensional model is always limited, because at sufficiently low temperature the system orders three-dimensionally. Okay, and so the question is this formula valid at temperatures of interest? And strictly speaking, the answer is no. I mean, although there is a fortuitous agreement between this formula and the experiments on spin half systems, this formula need not be valid at the temperatures relevant to real systems.
So according to the numerics and so on, how this diagram should change then? Can we still use this or not?
Okay, my feeling is that this formula is only valid somewhere around this critical point over here. This picture. Sorry? So, but nobody has drawn it yet.
No.
Well, it's easy to draw based on this simple criteria of comparing the correlation length with the thermal de Broglie wavelength and the lattice constant, basically, but that part of the phase diagram hasn't been drawn, really. Okay, just as I was saying, just the discussion of the two-dimensional Heisenberg model leaves out some interesting low energy physics, which we heard from Amnon Aharoni the other day, which involves anisotropies and couplings between planes. Which is ultimately responsible for the system developing three-dimensional order. And this, there's some very beautiful applications here of order by disorder phenomena, which I'll mention briefly in a few minutes. Which Amnon discussed the other day, but it seems to be well in control thanks to their work. The other part, which is somewhat mysterious from an experimental point of view, is the relatively high energy physics, which has to do with excitations at energies much larger than these spin wave energies. So, as I was saying, there's still unresolved the question of Raman scattering. Yeah.
How much do we know about the triangle lattice?
Yeah, I was going to come to that.
I'm sorry. Regarding the ground states, is it?
The triangular lattice, I think Claire, I hope, would give us a talk sometime. I mean, the triangular lattice is very well understood now to have an ordered state. And as Daniel was pointing out earlier, I mean, having an ordered state means having a certain degeneracy in the ground state in the thermodynamic limit. So if you look at a finite system, then a certain set of states should approach each other in some very precise way, and that's precisely what happens on the triangular lattice.
No.
So at zero temperature, the triangular lattice is also ordered. Okay, Daniel, how long should I continue here? Okay. I guess I had something much longer here, but basically I was trying to review some of the things that have happened in this field over the past few years. In my view, one of the most interesting questions really is, do spin half excitations exist in dimensions greater than one? Okay, we know that they exist in one dimension, but there's a simple way of even drawing, as Doug pointed out, you know, just as domain walls between two different phases in one dimension. We don't have such a simple domain wall picture possible in higher than one dimension. So do spin half excitations still continue to exist? And if they do, are they going to be the low energy excitations, or, as Matthew and Leon and others have pointed out, could they be high energy excitations? Okay. So even in the high TC materials, even in the square lattice, which is a model which is very well understood, it is clear that there is a lot of spectral weight which is outside of the spin waves. Okay. Neutron scattering experiments that Gabriel Epley, who's going to be here again sometime in November, has promised to tell us about. They're doing some very, again, painstaking neutron scattering experiments, and I think they find that something like 50% of the spectral weight lies outside these single magnon type excitations, okay, in the multi-magnon excitations. So is there a simple way to understand these excitations, okay, in the high TC materials? The Raman spectra, which is a fairly high energy, which probes, again, people naively think that the Raman spectra is really a two magnon spectra. It appears to be much broader than what theory would predict. So theoretical prediction would be something like this, and the experimental spectra is much broader. Now, many of Phil Anderson's collaborators have actually argued purely on at a phenomenological level that this can be better explained if we had if the elementary excitations were not magnons but spin half objects, because then, you know, each magnon, if you like, has some width to it, consists of two spinons. So this spectra could be much broader. So at a qualitative level they can explain it, but again, you know, as I say, that's really purely phenomenological. That is not starting from a microscopic model like the Heisenberg model. And the question of what happens to the higher energy excitations within the Heisenberg model is unclear. And certainly what happens, and maybe Matthew would argue that one needs to go beyond the Heisenberg model. Maybe some physics that involves the actual charge degrees of freedom may be important in trying to explain. I see Leon laughing there.
With respect to the cooperate photo emission, high resolution photo emission, people claim now that they see the spin on the one dimension, they don't, in the same experiment, don't see them in two dimensions.
But what does that mean? Well, I mean, this is a fact that these spectra are much broader, and nobody has come up with a good explanation for this. There are some explanations involving phonons and so on, but I don't think they are particularly good.
This is energy loss for that
experiment. But not the important benefit is also that it strongly resonates.
Yes.
Right? It strongly sends with the incoming light.
Right.
So it immediately tells us somehow, I think, the charge degree of freedom could be involved.
So they can create.
That's what they are bound to.
It's polarization dependent and
right on resonance.
Yeah, so Raman scattering is a process where you have light with some frequency coming in and going out at some other frequency over here, and the difference in these frequencies could be purely a spin excitation, but at intermediate stages definitely the higher the charge excitations are involved. There's no doubt about that. And so it could well be that the full description of this line shape would involve the high energy phenomena over here above the charge excitation gap. Okay, so but this remains really an open issue. People with computers have limited.
They can label all the energy levels.
In only a very small system.
That's the same question. So I guess, to what extent can you measure high energy dynamics numerically now? And is there some prospect for getting some definite
It's still very limited, really. I mean, the numerical work has been very good at studying ground state properties, thermal expectation values, single particle spectrum. Multi-particle spectrum, there is almost no work. Well, so, but I think a lot of people are working towards that. And
there have been some new approaches lately, right? I mean,
the DMRG,
for example.
There have been some, but I think they have been concentrating on one-dimensional systems, and that too, you know, things like spin one chains, where things are reasonably well understood.
Monte Carlo methods, where they have to somehow do an isometric.
So again, I don't know that. I mean, in the Monte Carlo methods, already getting the single particle excitation spectrum is tricky. So getting multi-particle, I mean, not much has been done so far. Really.
But this is on the undoped material.
This is on the undoped material, yes. Any of the material. This shows up in every single one of the materials, that this spectrum is way too broad.
And what's the frequency at which you get this peak?
This is about 3 times J. Mm-hmm. So this is certainly well below the charge excitation gap of the system. No doubt about that. But as Arno was pointing out, the physics of Raman scattering necessarily involves, you know, light coupling to the charge degrees of freedom. And so it involves exchange processes which happen at energy scales above the charge excitation gap. But how does that affect this scattering profile over here? Nobody has really produced a theory for that. Okay. Well, the only explanation that people have offered is by saying that the system couples to phonons and the phonons broaden the spectra. But the way they have tried to explain it is very unsatisfactory, because if the phonons really are so strongly coupled to the spin degrees of freedom, then they'll destroy all the other physics that I discussed, which agrees very well with the Heisenberg model. So certainly that phonon type explanation is not valid. Okay. So it's either something which is in the high energy excitation of the Heisenberg model itself, or it is something which involves this light scattering process, which necessarily goes through in.
But this is just a vortex which couples light to magnets. This shouldn't change. It can change intensity, but not.
But what is the nature of that vortex? No, one doesn't know. Vortex, sorry.
The system is more complicated than the Heisenberg model. Yeah,
right. Certainly at high energy. So I guess one of the messages is that the system, in general, solid state systems are very complicated, but a simple model like Heisenberg model is an extremely quantitative model, okay, and explains many properties very well. But one still has to think about lots of other properties. Let's see. Maybe at some stage we'll have a discussion from Claire and maybe even other people about Kagome lattice antiferromagnets. So, which is a system which definitely does not have long range order and has a spin gap, and what kind of low energy excitation it has is really a very interesting question. Is certainly very different from many other models. Okay, and in my view, one of the most interesting theoretical questions is, can we have spin half excitations in higher than one dimension? Okay, and that question very much remains an open question. Let's see. Maybe I should just stop here. Yeah.
Okay, maybe we can have a continuation at a different time about other related problems.
Yeah. Okay.
What we showed us is we have in these models we have all the physics of field theory. I mean the confinements, we have all kinds of excitations.
Asymptotic freedom, yeah, I didn't talk about those
freedom,
things, but
we have the symmetry breaking. Do we have strings? Well, strings the only thing left.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, we certainly have. Yeah.
That's unkind.
Okay, are there other questions or comments? That case, thank you.
Thank you.